The store sheets will be distributed in a minute. There are two versions of the store sheet. This is the updated one that I have here. Major who asked that question? Jason, major pedagogic educational tool. Don't give out your source sheets at the beginning. Right? The moment when you deploy the source sheets is critical, right? Otherwise, I can give them out right now. None of you will listen to anything that I'm saying for the first few minutes. You'll just be reading the source sheets and everything will be spoiled. Sometimes I've even done multiple source sheets per shear in order to do them at different moments. Okay. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. This is part two of Jewish political thought. Like I said, I'm being a bit cheeky calling this a Gemara Shira. Last week there was one Gemara in it of multiple sources, and it was primarily in Tanakh. This week, there is a Mishnah, but the vast majority of it is the Rambam. Nevertheless, it is absolutely a Torah Sheba'al Peh Shiur, a Torah of text, of study, of oral law, of our tradition. Last week, the Shiur focused on the passage in Sefer Devarim, chapter 17, Perek Yud Zayin, which also happened to happily correspond with Parashat Shoftim. It was the passage looking at the king as the obvious embodiment of political power. And starting with the Pesukim themselves, the verses, and then moving on to the Gemara, we asked the question of how does this read? Does it seem like there is an actual positive commandment to appoint a king? It's one of the mitzvot of the Torah. Perhaps it's even a great mitzvah, one of the three mitzvot which Israel are commanded upon entry into the land. Or perhaps is it actually not to be viewed in such a positive light? Rather, it's just an accommodation to human need. It's foreseen that at some point in the future, the people are going to ask for a king. And so they are given one if they want to have one, but the Torah does not necessarily view a king in such an ideal sense. And we really saw this take on a very harif, a very sharp expression when we looked several hundred years later into the Tanakh at Sefer Shmuel, which is the time when the people first asked for a king. And Shmuel sees it in extremely negative terms. He sees it as a rebellion not against his own leadership as the Navi, but he sees it as a rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, against God himself. And God seems to agree with this, but he says, nevertheless, grant the people their wish. And we finished looking at Shaul, at the first king, this funny story of him going to find his father's donkeys, and we said how that seems to sort of tick lots of boxes, referencing back to chapter 17. The king's not supposed to have too many horses. Shaul doesn't have horses, he's got donkeys. The king's not to have too much gold or silver. Shaul hasn't got any money, he's got to borrow it from the lad that's with him, etc., etc. And we said that that nevertheless seems to point in a more positive direction, that here's this first king who actually looks quite promising. So to jump, for now, from the period of the Tanakh all the way to the 20th century for our introduction. In the years before Hakamat Medina, the Declaration of Independence, Medinat Yisrael, the chief rabbi was who? Not Rav Kook. Who was the chief rabbi after? Rav Herzog, right? Rav Chaim Halevi. Herzog, who was originally a rabbi in the UK, always like to claim people when we can. It's very rare that if you're from England, you can claim somebody of significance in Jewish history. But Rav Herzog is one of them. Rav Herzog became chief rabbi after Rav Kook. And he devoted a huge amount of thought to the question of what was going to be the role of the Torah in the new Jewish state. Not the role of the Torah in the sense of what do we do with our pots and pans and how do we keep Shabbat, but the role of the Torah in the government, in the actual apparatus of state, something that had never existed before. And Rav Herzog was convinced and was excited by the fact that now in Medinat Yisrael, the Torah, Jewish law, could play a critical and fundamental role in the ideas of government and in the setting up of a court system, which it never would have been able to do so in the diaspora until then. And as part of his research, he wrote to Chachmei Hador, the sages all around the world. And probably the most important person he wrote to, anybody familiar who's considered to be Gadol Hador in Europe at the time? Yeah, exactly. Reb Chaim Ozer Brudinsky was one of the great sages, probably the greatest sage of the generation, lived in Lithuania. And Rav Herzog was shocked to receive Rav Grudinsky's response. Herzog had written, expecting that people would write back saying, "Wow, what an exciting opportunity that we now have to put the Torah and the Medina together." And Grudinsky wrote back recommending that two parallel systems be set up. One would be a rabbinic system of batei dinim, of courts, just like had functioned in the diaspora. And the other one would be a secular system which would legislate even when it would run in contrast and in conflict with the Torah law. And this is what Rav Grudinsky was recommending he set up. Now, Rav Herzog was shocked at this. Firstly, he challenged it on practical terms. How can two parallel systems exist under one roof? But secondly, he saw it as a tremendous missed opportunity. Here you've got the greatest Jewish experiment in 2,000 years. For the first time, the Torah can be incorporated into the idea of government. And here is Rav Grudinsky saying that we shouldn't try to do so at all. We should keep them separate. Now, Rav Herzog and Rav Grudinsky weren't making things up themselves. They were both drawing on very strong theories that had been written in the Middle Ages. One was the Rambam, Maimonides, and the other one was the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim of Girona. These two models were fundamentally opposed to one another in terms of how they understood the relationship between the Torah and politics, the idea of the king or the idea of political power. And we're going to look at the two in the next 2 weeks. Today we're going to focus on the Rambam, and next week we're going to look at Rabbeinu Nissim. And quite aside from just being relative values, it wasn't a question of deciding halakha, that Rav Herzog thought the Rambam was a greater authority and Rav Grudinsky thought the Ran was a greater authority. Much of it was also connected to where Rav Herzog and Rav Grudinsky were in the Jewish world. Rav Grudinsky was the rabbi of Lithuania, very much not Zionist, probably not anti-Zionist, but he certainly didn't see in the State of Israel anything particularly positive from a Jewish perspective. At best, it would be a state ruled by Jews rather than a Jewish state. And so he didn't want to invest in the State of Israel any particular Torah sanction at its center. Rav Herzog, by contrast, a deep religious Zionist student of Rav Kook, saw the opposite. The State of Israel was actually going to be the goal, the embodiment of everything that that the Torah sought to achieve. So that's a... So it's fascinating that their debate goes back to the Middle Ages in order to find its source. So that's where our focus is going to be for the next few weeks, looking at this golden era of Jewish writing in the Middle Ages about these questions. Thus, by way of introduction, this week and next week we're going to sort of see the texts originally that informed Rav Herzog, Rav Grudinsky, and really to a great extent the questions that we have today. So, Jason, at this point we can... give out these source sheets. Do take one and pass on. These are updated ones that I began today. So before we get to the Rambam, let's begin really with the fundamental question which Jewish politics has to start with, and that is dealing with a tension at the very heart of what politics is. I've not got enough for one each. I'm very sorry. Brandon, are you good to photocopy? Yeah, thank you so much. And that is dealing with a tension really at the very, very heart of everything that politics is. Because politics is really about power. And it's about human power and the idea that humans and leaders exercise power in order to make things happen in their stead. Now, what is just the most basic Jewish potential opposition to that? Answer: there is somebody already else who controls power, and that's not a person of flesh and blood. That is HaKadosh Baruch. Okay? Let's read something from Sefer Tehillim. Okay? So going all the way back to Sefer Tehillim. Shir HaMalot LeDavid. Kuf Kaf Dalad. Song to the heights of David. Lulei Hashem. Were it not for God, Shehaya Lanu, who was to us, who helped us out, who saved us, Yomar Na Yisrael, let Israel say that. So it's an interesting, from a literary perspective, basically that line is going to give like the anthem or the chorus, which is going to be repeated throughout the Mizmor. Lulei Hashem, without Hashem. Lulei Hashem shahayalanu, if God hadn't been there for us, b'kum aleinu Adam, when men rose up against us, azai chayim balanu, they would have swallowed us up alive. B'charot apam banu, when they rose with their anger against us. When enemies tried to attack us with their fury, with their anger, if it hadn't been for God, if God hadn't saved us, we wouldn't be here. Azai hamayim shatfunu, the waters would have swallowed over us. Nachala avar al nafshenu, the stream would have overwhelmed us. Azai avar al nafshenu, it would have poured over us. Hamayim hazidonim, the water. And then it finishes off again, the psukim that I didn't put on it. Lulei Hashem, if God hadn't been with us, we would have been destroyed. Okay? So what does that Mizmor seem to say? Where does power, where does salvation come from? What is our... What do we rely on when we're going to be attacked? Answer: Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's no mention of a human leader. There's no mention of an army. There's no thanking God, thanking the police for having been there. It's Hashem who saved us. Everybody ready to see something delicious? Volunteer to read the next source. More source sheets are coming. Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Please, are you okay with the Hebrew?
We'll see. Rabbi Chanina Sagana Kohanim Omer, Heve mitpalel bishloma shel malchut, she'ilmalei mara'a ish et re'ehu chayim balel.
Translate.
Rabbi Chanina, the deputy of the priest, would say, one should pray for the welfare of the state.
Pray for the welfare of the state. The state, government, politics, that is something that we should pray for. Right, the Medina gives us something very useful, gives us something very great. Carry on.
For were it not for the fear of it, each man would swallow his fellow alive.
If you didn't fear the state, we would all be devoured. Anybody see anything funny there?
Looks like the opposite sentiment of the first.
What's the specific phrase?
I was swallowed alive.
Chaim Balo. Clearly, that is taken from Tehillim, right? You can do a search on Bar Ilan and see that the only reference in history of our Jewish texts, at least ones that we have, prior to this Mishnah of being swallowed alive, refers to this Mizmor. But everybody see the lovely irony of it? It's a complete inversion of it. The Mizmor Tehillim says, were it not for Hashem, we'd have been swallowed alive by man. And here comes Rabbi Chananya Skan HaKohanim, says you've got to pray for the state, you've got to pray for the welfare of the state. We do it every Shabbat, seemingly it's a very, very long tradition of praying for the welfare of the state. If we weren't to, we would be swallowed alive. The state is what stops us from being swallowed alive, as opposed to Sefer Tehillim, which says it's Hashem which stops us from being swallowed alive. So is it Hashem's power, or is it human power? Somebody help us solve this contradiction.
It's like both simultaneously.
Go on.
How like when it comes to like building a Beit HaMikdash, we always say like Ibanat Beit HaMikdash, like Hashem will build the Beit HaMikdash. But at the same time, if man doesn't build the Beit HaMikdash, it's not kosher. So it's kind of like they both happen at the same time. And the same thing with like free will versus God controls everything. They simultaneously happen.
So you're saying something very interesting, which is actually you've jumped a whole stage and you said this is a general theme of Jewish thought. Jewish thought really as a whole Jewish belief combines both God's actions with man's actions, which is probably very, very correct. Ben?
Well, just picking up on that statement, it's more like we have to believe that certain individuals are endowed with God's knowledge and are acting as like a complete extension of God. And in those cases, whether it's like building the Beit HaMikdash, like do the Shem Shemayim with like tapping into essential wisdom, mm-hmm. We could say the same thing about the state. It's like the state as an extension of God will keep us from devouring each other.
Mm. Okay, yeah, fair. Ben Sion, is that a hand or just a stretch? Yeah, Jason.
Why couldn't we say that it's, on the one hand, if we don't follow what Hashem says, then we'll swallow each other alive? Okay?
Sorry, say that again.
On the one hand, why can we say that if we don't follow what Hashem says, that'll lead to problems? And on the other hand, additionally, if we don't follow, if it weren't for the government, additionally, we'd also have problems.
That additionally idea is an interesting one, because you're sort of, you're saying it's not a combination, it's rather there are two separate sources. On the one hand, you've got to listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. On the other hand, also, the state is what preserves us. I think that's, I mean, you could certainly say that. I think that's a slightly difficult thing to say, only because it seems to be, I mean... I mean, at least the way in which I hear you, it sounds like they're referring to two different things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu in one sphere, the state in another sphere, which Lahavdil is in many ways what sort of the Christian concept of politics was, Caesar and God as two separate powers. But here it seems to be that they're referring to the same thing, right? The Mizmor Tehillim says we would be swallowed alive were it not for God. And then the Mishnah says we would be, you'd better pray for the state, because if you don't pray for the state, we would, because were it not for the state, we would be swallowed alive.
Okay,
it seems to be they're talking about exactly the same topic. Jackie?
Well, just based on what Ben was saying, I mean, the way that we got the laws of the state are from the Torah. Like, we know what to do if someone murders, we know what to do if someone steals because of the Torah. So it is the state, like what Ben was saying, is just an extension, a manifestation of God's commandments to us.
So your statement is going to very much depend really on the machloket between Rav Herzog and Rav Grudinsky, which is in turn based on the different views of the Rambam and the and Rabbeinu Nissim. So we'll come back to that. Pinchas?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I like this answer, but just looking at the context of the Tehillim versus the Mishnah, Tehillim is specifically referring to when others from outside are attacking us, while the Mishnah is referring to infighting within itself. It's Ishit Re'ehu Chaim B'la'o. Each man would swallow his friend, so perhaps that's the reason I don't like it, because why would there be different spheres? Why would there be different forms of protection? Perhaps God is protecting from outside enemies attacking while the state is what protects.
Well, historically, we know that when we have an outside influence, it's much easier to find common unity, as opposed to during times of peace is usually when we have the biggest strife amongst ourselves. It's like now, if there's like, you know, Jewish people are having like a relatively good time in America, but that's when there's greatest tension within denominations, and you could see like the flare coming up. But if we have an enemy, it's very easy to band together and just say we are a Jewish people, and there's something else that's coming after us.
There's a Gemara which sums that idea up pithily, where it says that Ahasuerus did more for Jewish peoplehood than all of the Nevi'im combined, which is also a political statement. So I think really I've over-egged the contradiction between the Mizmor and the Mishnah, and really it's relatively simple, what at least the way in which one would explain Rabbi Hanina's idea, and that is that Rabbi Hanina says, of course you should pray for the state, because the state practically is what allows us to sleep safe in our beds at night. But by referencing the Mizmor Tehillim, he's saying, what is the power behind the state? What is it that grants mankind the ability to form political associations and wield power? Of course, it's God's power behind that, right? So it's an idea which allows for human politics and understands God's role as being behind that, okay? And God's role as legitimizing that. Now, that in itself is a statement which would then need a lot more definition, and that definition, the different ways in which you could understand it, is what we're really going to look at in the coming 3 weeks, when we look at the Rambam, at Rabbeinu Nissim, and then in the third week, hopefully, we'll be able to look at the Abarbanel, which are all going to be three very, very different understandings of, really, what is the relationship between this Mizmor Tehillim and this Mishnah. We won't do the Me'iri for now. The Me'iri is just a very good commentary on this. You can read it in your own time. Let's get to the Rambam. The Rambam is the earliest of the people that we're going to look at. And the way in which we need to start with the Rambam is we're going to ask ourselves the following question. And that is, we speak, in English, we use the phrase divine law, right? There is law that just exists in any society. And then the Torah's law is divine, okay? It's from God. Now, what makes law divine? So the simplest answer would be God gave it. If God gives the Torah, then that makes whatever law appears in the Torah divine. Okay? Interestingly, the Rambam doesn't use that approach. Rather, he says, don't think about its origins per se, think about its goals. What does the Torah set out to achieve? And by looking at what the Torah sets out to achieve, with that we're going to have an idea of what makes the law of Moshe, the law of the Torah, into its unique significance. So let's do a little bit of Chevrutah. What I want you to look at is this very, very important chapter in Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam's great philosophical work, part 3, chapter 27. And then, when you've looked at it, then look at the first couple of sources. I guess source number one, and if you've got time, source number three, is the way in which the Rambam then understands the king as playing a role within that. So turn to the person next to you. If you don't know them, all the better. And let's get learning. We'll just do a few minutes. Oh, sorry. Bochum, and then sources one and three.
Soul consists of a multitude acquiring corrupt opinions corresponding to their respective capacities. As for the welfare of the body, it consists of by the improvement of their ways of living one another. As for the welfare of the body, it consists of between these two aims.
Let's come back together. So let's begin with this first source, Moreh Nevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed. Everybody know why I put it in English and not in Hebrew? Really? Exactly. Anybody here speak Judeo-Arabic, lingua franca of North Africa in the Middle Ages? Karen, you do?
I speak a little bit of it.
Oh, okay. Right. Me neither. So why make you struggle with a translation in Hebrew when you can read a translation in English? What is it about Torah law that makes it Torah law? Answer. What does it aim at? Two things. Welfare of the body and welfare of the soul. Okay? There are things which are both religious, sort of small r, quote unquote, and there are things which are political. What's the chiddush of the Rambam? Both of those are religious. Even in our social relations with one another, even in the way in which a state is set up, the Torah addresses itself to that. The Torah addresses the totality of the society. So the Torah is not just interested in do you believe the right things and do you daven nicely and do you keep Shabbat well in your home. The Torah is also interested in the way in which the society is set up and the society is run. Note, therefore, that if you don't have both of those, then it's not going to be divine law. It's not going to be Torah law. You require both of those. So Ian asked me, the Meiri says something pretty similar to this. There are these two traditions. And Ian asked about that line at the end of the first paragraph. Although the latter can exist without the former cannot exist without the latter. Although the politics can exist without the religiosity can't exist without the politics. Why is that? Why does the Torah, why do the Chachamim, if you like, why does the spiritual end, the welfare of the soul, require the first, the welfare of the body, but not the welfare of the body, the soul, Lisa?
Well, he says it in here, a man cannot represent to himself intelligible thought if he is in pain, or is very hungry, or thirsty, or hot, or is very cold.
Exactly. Right, there is a point at which you have to guarantee your first basic abilities to keep warm, to have enough food, to be healthy, before you can start then thinking them, what is admittedly much more important, says the Rambam, but nevertheless, it comes after you've satisfied your basic needs. You're not going to be able to learn Gemara, you're not going to be able to pray, you're not going to be able to think the philosophical thoughts that the Rambam wants you to, if your stomach is completely empty and if you haven't been able to sleep because you're so terrified of Cossacks bursting in. So you require the politics in order to be able to have the religion. But again, the chiddush of the Rambam is that the politics itself is also what the Torah is interested in. Okay? So the Rambam, by the way, Moreh Nevuchim, much of it is really sort of just an explanation, a compendium of what all the mitzvot are about, and he sort of goes through so many of them. And so many of them, he's saying, this mitzvah is there in order to instill this value in society. This mitzvah is there in order to get rid of that negative aspect. Not just the obvious ones like lotzer tzach, lotik nov, don't murder, don't steal, but even ones which you wouldn't have thought of as necessarily having a political idea. The Rambam really sees them as having that role. How does this then fit into the king? What would you say is the way in which, for those of you who were there last week, doesn't matter if you weren't, but what reading is the Rambam having of the idea of the king? Lisa?
Well, Naomi and I thought that just like first you have to take care of your own physical needs and then you can learn Torah and like perform it for Hashem. So two, you need a king to rule you first and you listen to him, and that's like a basic need that you have to satisfy, and only then can you focus on like the Beit HaMikdash and wiping out Amalek and all that.
So are you saying that you don't think that the Rambam sees the king as having primarily a political role, or does he also have an elevated religious role?
We saw it as just like a basic political role.
Interesting. That does seem to be the position of the Meiri on the previous page, but it seems to me that actually, yeah?
He said that like the king's intentions have to be completely pure for God, and everything he does has to be for the sake of
right.
Everything religious.
Did you get to source number three? Here he describes, doesn't he? The king can conquer lots of lands and decide what he wants to do with them. It sounds like he's just like, that's political power. But the bit that I made bold, whatever he does, b'holi yu masav l'shem shamayim, source number three, Hilchot Malachim, all of his actions he needs to do for the sake of heaven, v'tihyeh magamato v'machshavato, and his aspiration and his thought, l'harim dat ha'emet, to elevate the true religion, v'limalot ha'olam tzedek, and to fill the world with justice, v'lishbor zra'o ha'rasha'im, v'hilachem milchamot Hashem, to break the hands of the wicked, to fight the wars of God. He there is investing the king, or we can say he's investing government politics. Let's call it the king for now, because you know, if the king equals government is, I guess, a question when you come to the 20th century. He is giving the king enormous religious role. He's seeing the king as having a huge role in achieving the Torah's aim. So he's not, the king isn't just the person who's allowing you to sleep in your bed at night and providing the safe infrastructure to keep warm, etc. He's really doing a huge amount more than that, right? The king himself is a religious leader. Anybody got any other thoughts at this point? Yeah, Ian.
So I was just, when I was reading the Rambam, I compared and contrasted it to the Mishnah, Pirkei Avot, and there seemed to be a little bit of a difference, because the Mishnah said that one should pray for the welfare of the state, for were it not for the fear of it, each man will swallow his fellow alive. And the Rambam's not saying that necessarily that...
Well, that sort of okay, was what Eliza was on along those lines. Okay. Right? Eliza was saying that, well, what's the role of the state to make sure that you don't swallow each other alive? The Rambam is saying it is that, and it's a lot more than that as well. Right? It's to really to achieve everything that the Torah envisions. If you want to see it in a very line, this. So I put different. The Rambam wrote multiple works. So we started with his latest work, Morin Avuchim. Source number one, not the first source. I know that's confusing. Source number one is actually his earliest work, or one of very early works, Sefer HaMitzvot, where he goes through the Torah and lists the 613 mitzvot, and this is the commentary on the mitzvah to appoint a king. He views it in very positive ways, one of the three things that Israel does when they enter into a land. He quotes the Gemara in Horayot, Melech, I've got one Gemara in, Melech Kodem Lanavi. The king comes before the prophet, and the way in which the Rambam understands that, the king comes before the prophet in the respect, in the awe, in the honor with which is due to him. In other words, what does the king represents more than the Navi? If you want to put it into Tanakh terms, David HaMelech represents more than Natan the idea of what of our religious reverence and of achieving the goals of the Torah. Let's do an interesting historical game now. Who's the first king of Israel?
Shaul.
Everybody says Shaul, and that's correct. And that Shaul is historically the first king of Israel. But really, the Rambam, I don't think, is looking at Jewish history like that. I think, who would the Rambam see as the first king of Israel?
David.
No? Well, Hashem, in true and certain sense. Sorry?
Moshe.
Exactly. Right? Because at a certain point in Tanakh, we get the political model, a melech, a prophet, and king. And the king represents political power and hopefully will achieve good things. But the prophet is the religious check on him. But it didn't used to be like that. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is he? Is he the political leader? Is he the religious leader? Answer is, of course, he is both. And in the Rambam's view of things, that is truly and surely the ideal. And it continues with Yahushua as well. And then the split between political power and religious message, that's really very traumatic for the Rambam. That is not something that he would have wished to have taken place.
Even though Moshe set up all the different like levels of the like judicial system and all the different...
Well, to say that a king is imbued with really great reverence doesn't mean that he doesn't need apparatus in order to help him. He's not going to be answering every individual individual question.
Meaning that not that was split to say that all those other people kind of handled the political part of it and he left...
I don't think... I think
the religious part of it.
I mean, admittedly, the way in which you read... Yitro and the setting up of courts is a very interesting question, and somebody like the Abarbanel, who we'll get to in a few weeks, has got a very different reading of what happened there to many others. But no, I think it would be the equivalent, if you're talking in American terms, of Moshe remaining as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and obviously there are lower ones that are delegated. John?
In a basic sense, Moshe and Yeshua are not in line with Rambam's definition of a king, because they weren't chosen, right? Like, he says that you should appoint...
Because they weren't chosen and they weren't in the land, but what they...
I mean, they were chosen, but not by the people. He's saying that the people need to choose a king. But, I mean, that's not even that important. I guess where I'm going with this is that, it would make sense that Moshe and Yahushua could be religious leaders and carry out Torah and kind of live up to everything that it says in number 3, like that role of a king with regards to Torah, because they were chosen by Hashem. But even if it's in some super democratic way, and like all the people are electing a king, mm-hmm. I mean, people are still people. We make mistakes. We're not divine. So how is it that the choice for who is going to enact that divine law in the world is someone that's chosen by people? Later on in history, we elected some bad kings.
That's a very, very good point as to does the fact that the Rambam sees the king as having such an elevated status mean that automatically anybody who is a king occupies that elevated position? Not necessarily. That we'll get to in a moment. Naomi, do you?
Correct.
I guess I only meant it in sort of like a schematic way. Moshe is not a king because it's before they enter into the land. Nevertheless, the idea that political leadership is combined with religious leadership and it doesn't need to be separated into king and prophet, I think is something that you've really got at the heart of the Rambam. And I guess Yahushua is a good example of there already in the land having it. Karen.
John. That's exactly why I think that the king has to constantly have a copy of the law with him to remind him to include
Did you see source number 2?
So
source number 2 is exactly that. So it's worth reading. For those of you who are here on Shabbat morning, it was exactly Josh's Devar Torah about why the king has to have two Torah scrolls. Surely just the one which everybody has is enough. So, I mean, see how you read this. I didn't put a translation. It could be what Karen is saying. It's the bottom of the second page, source number 2. When the king is on his throne, he needs to write a Sefer Torah for himself, yeter, additionally, than the one that he's inherited, his family one. It has to be done completely correctly. If if he hasn't inherited one, or it's lost, Kotev Shnei Sifrei Torah, he has to write two. Echad minicho be'b'gnei chazav, one he leaves at home, shehu mitzuvah bo'kecholef, just like everybody's commanded to have a Sefer Torah, so too he is. V'hasheni, and the second one, lo yazuz milfanav, has to stay with him always. So although the king has two Sifrei Torah, they're not actually always with him. One is in his personal home, the other one is always with him, except... I don't know why the Rambam needs to say this. Ella be'et shikanes le'beit hakiseh, except when he goes to the bathroom. Okay. Or le'beit hamerchatz, or to wash himself. Or le'makom she'en rori le'kriya, or a place where you shouldn't read it. However, any other time, yotzeh le'milchama, if he goes out to war, hu imo, the Torah's with him. Nichnas, he comes back, hu imo, the Torah's with him. Yoshev badin, he's judging, hu imo, the Torah's with him. Meisav, v'hu kenegdo, if he's sitting down, presumably eating, drinking, it's there with him. So, Shneemar, v'hayta imo, it shall be with him, v'karabo kol yamei chayav, and he reads all the days of his life. So what's the symbolism of the second Torah? The Rambam doesn't clearly say, it could be that like Karen, sorry Karen, go on, what was your reading of why the second Torah is with him? So that was Josh's Devar Torah, and I think that's, I'm sure that's very correct, that maybe kings need a sort of an extra check beyond what other people do. But the sort of feeling I get from the Rambam, I can't prove it, but the sort of feeling I get from that halacha we just read is the Torah is always with the king because the king represents the Torah. Right? V'hu imo, wherever he goes, it's with him. It's sort of like, in a sense, part of the royal procession. He's not just the person who allows politics to take place, so then the religion can flourish. He is the religion itself. And so you've got something very interesting here. I sort of summed up the whole shir just in that subline at the top of the page. The religion serves the state. It gives it its support. It sees the king as its... gives him incredible prestige. But the state also serves religion, because the role of the state is to strengthen, is to elevate the role of the Torah. Source number four... is an interesting one. It'll be more relevant for next week, that the Rambam says that in a case where you can't convict somebody according to Torah law, right? Let's say a murder. What do you require in order to convict somebody of a murder? Two witnesses, two kosher witnesses, and
a warning
as well, right? These are, by almost any legal code, these are extremely high standards that are required, right? What happens when you've got one witness who you may is a completely reliable person? Right, last week's parasha, al pishnayim edim yakum davar, you require two witnesses, you can't do anything. According to the Torah, you can't put somebody to death, but you can't punish a murderer for a murder which has got a clear witness if you haven't got two witnesses. So what does the Rambam say? Source number four, v'chol elu haratzchanim, murderers, v'chayotze bahem, she'enan mechuyavin mitat beit din, who the beit din themselves can't punish, im ratza melech Yisrael lahogam, if the king wants to put them to death, b'din ha-malchut, b'takanat ha-olam, according to the law of the king and tikkun olam, this is tikkun olam, right, through fixing the world, ha-rashut b'yado, he is able to. So the king can establish law even when the Torah itself is not able to. Remember for next week, what's the Rambam's example? That of murder, and through allowing that, then the king has a check on there just being too many unpunished crimes in the state. So the Torah, the king's power goes beyond the Torah when it needs to. We're going to finish with this. John said, how could it be that people could appoint a king? Just human choice is obviously fallible, and what that suddenly makes somebody into the religious model. Well, the answer is that actually, despite everything that I've said until now, the Rambam saw multiple possibilities of what kingship could be. Right? Because what does the king have to achieve? Just go back to Moreh Nevuchim. The king has to fulfill the welfare of the body and the welfare of the soul. If the king doesn't fulfill the welfare of either of them, then you can rebel against him, then you can get rid of him. He does not have any role, and the Rambam would say you should get rid of him right there at that moment. You can rebel against him. He is not valid to be a king. What if he only fulfills the welfare of this body? He allows for political life, allows you to sleep in your bed at night. He doesn't fulfill the welfare of the soul. That, for the Rambam, what would you guess? What would you say? That for the Rambam is what he would identify with what's called Malchei Beit Yisrael, the kings of Israel. Israel meaning the northern kingdom in the time of the Tanakh kings, such as Ahav. Look at source number 5. This is in Hilchot Sanhedrin. Malchei Beit David, the kings of the house of David, Afal pi she'ein moshivin otam b'Sanhedrin, even though they don't sit on the Sanhedrin, Yoshvim v'danim hem et ta'am, they judge the people, v'danim otam, and they themselves can be brought to court, im yesh aleihem din, if there's a claim against them. Aval malchei Yisrael, but the kings of Israel, ein danin v'ein danin otam, they do not judge us, and we do not judge them, l'fi she'ein nichna'im lahen l'divrei Torah, they do not submit to the Torah, therefore we don't put the Torah law on them, Shema tavo mehen takala, lest it end in tripping us up. In fact, in Hilchot Malachim, he then puts the phrase a bit differently. The second half of the second line in source number 6, why do we not judge them and why do they not judge us? Mipnei sheliban gas bahen, because they are arrogant. Vayovim en hadad takala vehefsed al hadad, it will end up doing damage to Judaism if we view these kings in a religious sense as well. So he recognizes the idea of a king who is purely political and not a religious model. So that, in a sense, is the answer to your question, John, how if human choice is fallible. The answer, the Rambam recognizes that. He calls that Malchei Beit Yisrael. The king that he has described, this more ideal king, is Malchut Beit David, the kings of the house of David. That's the previous sources. And then, it won't surprise you that given that the Rambam already sees the king with such a great and elevated role, that actually, we use the phrase Melech HaMoshiach, the King Messiah. That's not by chance, because for the Rambam, Moshiach is the king, is going to be a king, and Moshiach is political. This is so, so important, right? Because so many messianic visions see the idea of politics ending and see the idea of just regular law, in our version, halacha ending. Right? Halacha is for this world, messianic times, you don't need halacha. The Rambam includes, anybody know where in Mishneh Torah he includes Moshiach? The very, very end, the final perek, the final chapter of all of Mishneh Torah, of this great halachic work, is about Moshiach. Says the Rambam, source number 8, Al ya'aleh b'da'atcha, don't think shehamelech ha-Moshiach tzarech la'asot otot u'moftim, that the king Moshiach needs to do wonders, miracles, and mechadesh dvarim, make new things, ba'olam u'mechayeh meitim, or to revive the dead. This is not how Moshiach is going to work. Rather, he is going to be the very best king there possibly is. Right? That is who Moshiach is. The Rambam subjects Moshiach to halacha and to politics. But just the final thing to end with, the thing which maybe seems to contradict everything we've said until now, but it doesn't contradict, it's just the Rambam's final world vision. These are the very final halachot of all of Mishneh Torah. At the time of Moshiach, or maybe even post-Moshiach, this is the Rambam's vision for that time, that period. Not only is it going to be a world without a king, it's going to seem to be a world without politics whatsoever. Says the Rambam, the final one, source number 9, Lo litavu hachamim v'hanevi'im yemot Moshiach. The sages, the prophets, didn't yearn for Moshiach. Lo kadei sheyishlatu al kol ha'olam, for the purposes of ruling over the world. That wasn't why they wanted Moshiach. Not in order to rebel against the nations. Not to eat and to drink and to celebrate. That's not why we look for Moshiach. Rather, just to be free, to be able just to sit and dwell and learn Torah and to dwell in wisdom. There shouldn't be anything stopping them to do that. In other words, a world free of distractions, where we have to worry about politics. How are we going to have enough food? How are we going to survive? That is what Moshiach is going to get rid of, politics, in the sense that we will be free. We will be able just to learn, to study, to be in kollel the whole time. Ubotan hazman, and at this time, the very final halacha in all of Mishneh Torah, right? The Rambam, a decade of writing Mishneh Torah, this is how he finishes off. At that time, Lo yesham lo ra'av v'lo milchama, there will be neither famine nor war. Lo kina v'lo tacharut, not jealousy, not competition. Sha'atova tihye mushba'at harbe, goodness will be dispersed throughout the world, v'chol ha'adanim, and all of the delights of the world, the delicacies mitzuyin ka'afar, will be found like dust everywhere. V'lo yihye esek kol ha'olam. Take that phrase very seriously. And the business of the whole world will only be ladat tashem bilvad, to know God, to comprehend God. And Israel will play a very central role in that. They will have, they will be at the heads of those who know God, lefikach yu Yisrael chachamim gedolim, etc., etc. But in other words, it's a world without politics, a world seemingly in which the whole universe is contemplating God, and one which is only there for the study of God. Yes, Karen. What will Moshiach? Well, we should preface this halacha with saying the Rambam does not want you thinking about Moshiach a lot. He doesn't think that over concentration on Moshiach is a good thing, probably for exactly that reason. But it does add an interesting end to this. Everybody, Yashar Koach, thank you very, very much. Brandon.